Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. What is it about storytelling that has captivated humans since the beginning of time? Exploring that question is on some minds as the 40th anniversary Kentucky Women Writers Conference got underway today, running through Sunday the 22nd in Lexington. And here with details is Conference President Randy Ewing, herself a writer of fiction. Thanks for joining us, Randy.
Hi, Tom.
So first, let's get into the details. I mentioned that this is the 40th conference. It's happening now through Sunday. Tell us where and give us some of the highlights.
Yeah, so the conference begins Thursday night at the Lyric Theater. We kick off the conference with the Sonia Sanchez Lecture Series, which opens the conference with a writer whose ideas are helping shape Black culture and social justice issues. So tonight it will be Ifa Baeza, who's the author of the Emmett Till trilogy, and she'll be speaking at 7 p.m. at the Lyric Theater. Then on Friday, we'll have our keynote speaker, Jane Allison. Our original keynote speaker, Nicole Chung, had to cancel because of a family emergency, and Jane has stepped in to talk about narrative structures. She's an author of several books of fiction and nonfiction, and her latest is an exploration on writing and narrative forms. And then on Saturday at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center at 7 o'clock, we will have the Wild Women of Poetry Slam. That'll be headlined by celebrity judge Franny Choi, and that is a really good time for seeing poetry in an entirely different environment. Very personal, often political poetry, and it's kind of a contest of sorts that people will also get an award for at the end. Finally, on Sunday, we have the Stars of the Commonwealth reading. That is at the Carnegie Center in downtown Lexington, and it begins at 10 a.m. There'll be bagels served. All of these events are free and open to the public. And the Stars of Commonwealth features Kentucky authors. So we have three Kentucky authors that'll be reading there: Jessica Chiquetto-Hindman, Savannah Sipple, and Ashley Clark Thompson.
And is the conference mainly for women, or can anybody come?
No, anyone can come. The women in the title of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference is that the presenters are women writers, performers, playwrights, poets, what have you. But we are happy to welcome anybody who is interested.
It's really interesting that in these times of so many information sources and options at our fingertips, one ancient human favorite pastime endures, and that's storytelling.
Yeah.
It's an especially important and powerful presence in Appalachian culture. And I understand that the keynoter is going to talk about the ways to tell a story, the various structures that kind of might get us away from what has become habit.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people, when they learn about stories in school, they'll get kind of one narrative structure. So a lot of people will be familiar with rising action, climax, falling action. What Allison is going to look at is how there are different ways to tell stories. Not all stories fit that pattern. Often stories circle back around or meander. I think how often when someone's telling you a story, they kind of digress and lose their way and then come back. Those digressions can be important parts of the story. So she's going to look at the way that there are different, and talk about and speak to, the way that there are different types of stories and different patterns for those stories, which I think is really great, especially when we're thinking about a time right now. Storytelling is an enduring form, and it's never really fit into one particular pattern. And we're at a time right now where we're interested in seeing and hearing a whole bunch of different types of stories. So, you know, this conference is an opportunity for people, and her session on that is open to the public. It's an opportunity for people to kind of think about those other types of stories.
I think for a lot of people who have had the notion that they might want to write a book, then they think about what's involved and are intimidated. I understand that you have worked some workshops into the itinerary that might help people overcome these obstacles.
Yeah, this conference is for emerging and established writers alike. In fact, most of the people who attend the conference, most of the participants are people who are readers, they're strong readers, but they're also writers, and they want to explore what it might be to get some of that story of theirs down on the page. And so the workshops are a really kind of risk-free environment where they get to try out different genres of writing. Those workshop leaders are going to be offering prompts. They're going to help them get started or think about things in a new way. So often when we're trying to figure out how to begin a story, just the beginning is difficult. So if someone can give you a prompt or an idea that opens a different door into the story, I like to think about stories, and I think this applies to poems or anything that you're going to write, as kind of a house, and you're trying to find the door into it. But the truth is that any story has multiple doors and windows. There's lots of ways to break into that house. And so these workshops hopefully offer participants a way to do that. And I would say, in addition to the workshops, the open sessions, anytime you're listening to that conversation going on about writing, I think there's an opportunity to spark your own work.
I notice on the itinerary that you have a literary agent, Alice Spielberg, who will be there providing 15-minute consultations. What are those about?
What we'll do there is she'll have an open session where she speaks to how you can get an agent's attention. You know, a lot of times that comes in the form of a query letter and a sample. So she'll talk about what that might entail and what types of things make a writer jump off the page. But then there are also sessions that participants can sign up and pay for so that they can have an individual meeting with her. She'll go over one of those first few pages and give them some tips and insight about what is kind of working and what might work better if they were to revise.
Okay, we have just a little tiny bit of time left. I wanted to be sure to get a website out there. Can you give us your web address?
Yeah, so our web address is going to be womenwriters.as.uky.edu. And you can also just Google the Kentucky Women Writers Conference. It'll come up. We're the longest running women writers conference in the nation. And so I think you'll find us pretty easily.
Kentucky Women Writers Conference President Randi Ewing, we thank you so much, Randi.
Thank you.
And speaking of storytelling, there's a storytelling festival happening this weekend in Wilmore. Just go to wilmore.org and the information's right there. WEKU's Wendy Barnett joins the Eastern Standard Interview team, discussing a locally produced film that's about to make its debut.
A new documentary on a controversial mural at the University of Kentucky examines issues of race, history, and censorship. Filmmaker and EKU professor Dr. John Fitch joins me in the studio to talk about Painted in Stone, the Kentucky Mural. Dr. Fitch, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about your documentary.
Well, the film examines a 1934 mural that was painted as part of the Works Progress Administration by a Kentucky artist and was installed in Memorial Hall, which is kind of the central structure at the University of Kentucky. The hall itself was built in 1929, so it's been around for a while. And over the past 4 or 5 years, students have been protesting the mural. They've been unhappy with its placement. They've been unhappy that it's there because it contains depictions of slaves and African Americans in not the most flattering light. And so student groups protested the mural in April of 2019, asking that it be removed or covered up. And the University of Kentucky administration actually did cover it up. And that's when I decided to make the project, because the students had occupied the main administration building and had spent the night there in order to get an audience with Dr. Capilouto, UK president. So it was a very controversial topic that I thought would be good for a film.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope the audience gains after seeing it?
Well, I hope that they will gain a bigger picture of the controversy at University of Kentucky and also a better understanding of the controversial subject itself of public art in public spaces. I hope they get a better understanding of the history of the mural at University of Kentucky, history of African-American students at the university, and I hope it spurs a conversation, hopefully a well-educated conversation, about public art and public spaces, censorship and history, and what we as citizens should do with images and texts and art that is old, that is outdated. What should we do with that as we learn more about ourselves and as we learn to be kinder and more considerate of others, of minorities in our community. So I hope it sparks a conversation that an educated conversation between reasonable people. This is a conversation that's happening all over the country. You know, there's a mural in California right now that has George Washington in it, and there's an argument about whether it should be taken down because of its depictions of Native Americans. And this also ties into the controversy over Confederate statues in all across the country. So I just hope that people are able to approach this topic with a little bit more depth and understanding as a result of viewing this documentary. I know I do. I know that researching it for myself has changed the way I feel about it and has really helped me get my arms around the discussion and the debate in a way that I would not have been able to do if I hadn't had the entire picture.
What was the research project? How did that look?
Well, it wasn't easy because I had to delve into a lot of history that's not that well documented.
Mm-hmm.
The history of African American students at the University of Kentucky is not as well documented as some of other parts of University of Kentucky history. So I spent a lot of time at the UK archives,
mm-hmm.
diving into the Kentucky Colonel, back issues of the student newspaper. And the student newspaper in 1968 was run, in 69, was run by a group of students who were very active and very politically active and socially conscious. And they covered a lot of these issues that had not been covered before. They did amazing coverage on the Black Student Union, which was just begun around 67, 68. They covered the civil rights controversy. They covered some of the Vietnam War protests that were happening at the university. They covered things that the Colonel, the newspaper, had not covered before.
Hmm.
And so thankfully for that work that was laid down by Guy Mendez and some other young journalists at the time at the University of Kentucky paid off for me. And I was able to get a really nice collection of facts about what that experience was like at the University of Kentucky from the late 1960s up to the present day. So I'd spent a lot of time looking through Kentucky Colonel articles. I spent a lot of time working with the Lexington Herald Leader, their newspaper, looking through old articles. I also did a lot of image research at the University of Kentucky archives, which they were fantastic to work with. And it was really fun to look through some of those old photographs and old images and paintings and trying to piece together a history of the African-American experience in Lexington, Kentucky, and at the University of Kentucky since 1949. I also was able to work with a lot of the student activists who were involved both in the Basic Needs Hunger Strike campaign of 2019 and this mural protest to collect a lot of media. You know, everybody mm-hmm. has a phone now. Everybody's taking video. Everybody's taking photographs. And so it was wonderful to connect with these young people and for them to be generous enough to give me their images, lend me their video, because these were things that weren't covered by the mainstream press. And so now we have a lot more resources, thankfully, in this digital age than we did in the past. So it made the research less challenging than it was before.
Now, did you do the entire documentary by yourself, or do you have a team of people helping you?
Luckily, I had the help of four student interns who are broadcasting electronic media majors in the Department of Communication here at EKU. These film students were invaluable to the process. They each did 80 work hours over the summer, it was almost 12 weeks of work. They did everything from helping me edit, film, set up lights, record audio. They helped a little bit with the research. I was also really happy to have a student researcher who works in the EKU library. She specializes in archives, and so she was able to help me do a lot of the research, a lot of the hard work that needed to be done. And then I had the help of some colleagues who were filling in as vocal talent, and I was really fortunate to work with a friend of mine and an excellent local musician, Kevin Sparks, on the soundtrack. So I wasn't alone, thank goodness, and I was able to take advantage of a lot of really talented people and really benefited from their hard work, which is important when you don't have a budget at all.
Right. So. Now you have a couple of screenings ahead of you in Lexington and Richmond.
Yes, yes. The world premiere of the film will take place at EKU on September 24th at 6:30 p.m. It's open to the public. There's no admission. We would love to have as many people show up as possible.
Where on EKU's campus is that?
It's in the Whitlock Building in the O'Donnell Auditorium.
And in Lexington?
In Lexington, we will be screening at the Central Branch of the Lexington Public Library on September 26th at 7 p.m. That's also open to the public, no admission. I believe there's library parking down there, so we're hoping to have a big turnout there as well.
Wonderful. And how do people find out more?
One of the best ways to find out now is to go into Facebook and type in Painted in Stone, and you'll find an event page for each of those events.
Dr. John Fitch, filmmaker and EKU professor, on his new documentary, Painted in Stone, The Kentucky Mural. Dr. Fitch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break,
we're looking for someone who has excellent musical ability, musicality. We're looking for someone who is a phenomenal communicator.
Lexington Philharmonic Executive Director Allison Kaiser on some key characteristics required of the next Lex Phil conductor. There are six finalists. We hear from the first, Thomas Heuser. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Lexphil, the Lexington Philharmonic Orchestra, is in search mode, looking for the perfect candidate to succeed Scott Terrell, who led the orchestra for 10 years. The search process is intensive, and it spans the forthcoming season. And here with the details is Lexphil Executive Director Allison Kaiser. Thanks for coming in, Allison.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's begin by asking you to share with us all of the things that have to be taken into consideration when you're looking for that right person. What are you looking for in this conductor?
Well, we're looking for someone who has excellent musical ability, musicality. We're looking for someone who is a phenomenal communicator, both a communicator through the music that this individual will be leading, and a communicator one-on-one with individuals and other organizations that we will want to collaborate and partner with. The individual has to be absolutely passionate about the role of music in a vibrant community. And as we know, Lexington is a very special community when it comes to music. We're very rich in all genres of music. So we'll be looking at someone who can help us to build bridges between all the different genres, too.
So this should be a person who's comfortable with being the face of Lexphil, getting
absolutely
out into the community, meeting people, talking to people.
Absolutely. So, yes, we're looking for someone who has excellent on-podium skills and excellent off-podium skills.
What's your vision about growing your audience?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the Philharmonic, especially over the work that's been done over the last 10 years, I think is very well positioned to be looking at growing the audience. As you probably know, nothing happens quickly in the world of orchestras. It's a large organization with a lot of moving parts, and to get parts aligned and moving in the same direction can take some time. But over the course of the last 10 years under Scott's direction, we made tremendous strides in developing a much more diverse repertoire and helping our existing audience understand the excitement and the joy of exploring unknown repertoire. And so we will be on the artistic side looking at our new music director and conductor to continue that forward momentum, and also helping us to learn new and better ways to build bridges, better communication with the community, with other music forms and other art forms, so that we can become more of a nucleus and less of an isolated organization, but more of a nucleus to build community through the arts and through shared audiences with other art forms.
Getting back to the search process, this is one intense process, and you're down to six finalists.
Yes.
It's going to happen over the entire season.
Yes.
Tell us about it. How is it structured?
Okay. So we have each conductor finalist coming in to conduct one of our season series concerts, and we call those concert cycles. And so they will arrive. They'll spend just a little bit. They'll each spend about 8 days with us. And from the moment that we give them a rest the night that they get in, but then every day is packed with meetings, tours of the Bluegrass area, meetings with our various boards of directors. So, for example, we have the Society Board, which is the operating arm. We have the Foundation Board, which is our endowment arm. And we have our Guild Board. They will all be meeting with each candidate. Our staff will be meeting with each candidate in a one staff and conductor candidate situation. We will be opening up, having a reception, for example, during the day to invite community leaders, political leaders, and donors to come meet the candidate. After the concert, there will be an open invitation to everybody in the audience to come meet the candidate and ask questions. Then the search committee will have a one-on-one meeting with each candidate the day after each concert. And we'll conclude the whole week of activities with a fundraising opportunity where individuals will open up their homes to allow us to use that as a fundraising opportunity for people to come and meet the candidate. So we're trying to do everything from broad and wide open to fundraising with each candidate. And we feel like that's important because we need to see how each candidate reacts in those different situations and how they react in a rapid fire situation where we have just one activity and event. Every night is filled with rehearsal. So that part of their stay with us. Their evenings will be consumed with meeting the guest artists, talking with our musicians. Our musicians will have a one-on-one meeting with each candidate. I believe it's toward the middle of the week, so not the first rehearsal, but later in the rehearsal process. So we will be also gathering feedback from every one of these groups that meet with each candidate to provide to the search committee to help them to make their decision.
I sure do hope these folks have built in a couple of days off after this.
I hope so, too. We do try and give them 8 hours in which to sleep, but not a whole lot more.
So your season opener will be conducted by one of the finalists, Thomas Heuser, and we'll be talking with Thomas in just a few minutes. And this concert is coming up on Saturday the 21st, last evening, if you're listening to our Sunday evening broadcast. And the program features a piece with a very local connection. Tell us about Julia Perry.
Yes. Julia Perry was one of the early American female composers. And we are so honored to be able to open our season with one of her works. I think that, again, as we talk about how we want to not just grow audience, but also grow our community's connection and awareness of the realm of orchestral music, that this is an excellent way to open the season. Her work is a beautiful work. She is one of the unsung masters of composition, and we're very honored to have this opportunity. And as you have probably noticed, we are also featuring a female composer to open each program throughout the season. So we feel like it's a really good opportunity for us to take a fairly bold step forward in making sure that we do everything that we can to help our community and our audience members understand the depth and breadth of what is out there and available through orchestral music.
Is it coincidence, or is there a connection with the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment?
Well, I think there is connection. And there's been, of course, a lot of attention drawn to the role of women in leadership and in politics, especially over the last few years. And we feel that it's time that we draw that attention to the world of female leaders in composition as well.
Okay. And by the way, you can learn more about Julia Perry, who grew up in Lexington's East End neighborhood, by going to our site, esweku.com, click on the facts and information page, and there you will find a link to an article about Ms. Perry written by Tom Eblen. So I mentioned Thomas Heuser. Who are the other finalists?
Okay. After Thomas visits with us, we will have Akiko Fujimoto. And then following Akiko's visit with us, we will have Kelly Corcoran, and then Enrico Lopez Yanez, then Julia Tai, and then Kitaro Hirada in May.
And when do you hope to have a decision made and ready for announcement?
This summer. We won't really be able to get into any type of decision making until we've had an experience with each one of the candidates, and our search committee will then have to sift through and digest all of the feedback that we'll be gathering on each candidate.
So for you and for your general manager, Sarah Thrall, and everybody at Lexville, this is going to be one intense, busy year.
It is, but we're so excited about it because it gives us a phenomenal opportunity to open up a part of our organizational thinking to a much broader community. Most people would say that the inner workings of an orchestra is not something that they're familiar with. We want to bring all that up to the surface, make it much more transparent, and invite people into that process with us.
Wonderful. Allison Kaiser, Executive Director of the Lexington Philharmonic, Lexville. And we thank you so much, Allison.
Thank you, Tom.
So I mentioned conductor candidate number one, Thomas Heuser. He is or has been in Lexington this week, depending on when you're listening. We provide a link to Thomas's full bio on the facts and information page on our site, esweku.com. Currently, he is music director of the Idaho Falls Symphony, as well as the San Juan Symphony, a regional orchestra based in Durango, Colorado, and Farmington, New Mexico. We caught up with Thomas before he left Idaho Falls to make his way to Lexington to plunge into the whirlwind audition week that Allison Kaiser described. Greetings, Thomas.
Greetings, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about music here, obviously. What was it about music that it became your life's work? Was it your family? Was it maybe a performance that you experienced, a teacher that you had?
Great. Yeah, it's been part of my life since as far back as I can remember, you know, having a musical household. Definitely my parents are responsible for an introduction to music and encouraging my musical studies and career. And I think that after, you know, this early exposure at home, it did end up being the teachers that I was able to work with who inspired this kind of lifelong appreciation and the pursuit of the career. I remember some early piano teachers growing up in St. Louis who really inspired me to, you know, pursue harder and harder repertoire, more and more serious studies, and that eventually by the time I was choosing a career and having to make these big decisions, it was clear to me that music was the only way to go. And these days I say to young people, if you can imagine yourself doing anything besides music, you should probably do it because it's such a tough career to build. But evidently I picked the right one for me, and I've been very fortunate to have a career built around music. As you know, it's not an easy undertaking.
Is the piano your instrument of choice?
That's right. Yeah, I was a piano undergraduate major, and I'm now sort of an artist formerly known as pianist. It's something that I like to keep up for social engagements and, you know, sort of impromptu performances. But no, I'm leaving that to the classical pianists these days.
So how does one make that transition from a musician to conductor?
Sure. It's always an interesting thing, and there's really no set path. I would say that each conductor finds his or her own way to, especially these days, make it onto the podium with an orchestra. For me, it was through composing that I found out about conducting. I was writing in high school some Broadway shows and then original classical compositions in college that I had a chance to direct myself, and I realized that what is so wonderful about conducting is that it's a collaborative musical exercise. There's other people involved, that you get a chance to coach musicians and work with musicians on musical expression and ideas, and that really meant for me sort of a breakthrough, whereas I had been in the practice room as a piano player, very much a solo enterprise, and suddenly this wonderful world of conducting meant that I had other people to work with, and that suited me. So it was through my own writing and performing that I finally had a chance to try conducting, and it was a great fit for me.
What is the most exciting thing to you about the program that you're going to be conducting here in Lexington?
Oh, it's a wonderful program, a big program, lots of music to enjoy. I think there are many, many special components of this program. The concert is called Home, and that's largely because of the music of Julia Perry. Julia Perry was born in the 1920s in Lexington, so it was her home. She lived there for, I think, the first 10 years or so of her life before moving to Akron, Ohio, and then having a long career in Europe. I shouldn't say a long career, an extensive career with notable teachers like Dalla Piccola and Nadia Boulanger. But anyway, having this career that was actually cut relatively short due to health issues for her. But one of the most notable early American, African-American women composers still whose music is performed today. It's a wonderful opportunity to explore her works that are relatively unperformed. That kicks off a performance of the Stravinsky Violin Concerto, one of the most technical works for the solo violin in the repertoire. A wonderful chance to work with Stefan, whom I've not worked with before. We have some things in common, though. His parents are both physicists. Mine are both biologists, evidently. So I can't wait to touch base with him on what that means. But of course, the big bulk of the program is Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, and it's one of the most passionate works of Tchaikovsky's, his last symphony, his last work. He actually conducted the premiere just a week or so before he passed away. Incredibly emotional and significant because of its autobiographical nature for Tchaikovsky. And it's just incredibly passionate music that showcases the orchestra. And as a guest conductor, as a music director finalist, it will provide so much opportunity to work with the musicians, to get to know the musicians of the Lexington Philharmonic and bring this incredible music to life. I can't wait.
Thomas, if you were pressed to describe your musical personality, what would you say?
That's a good question. Again, I think about conductors, it's such an individual art. You know, there's as many different styles of conducting and personalities as there are conductors, I would say. You know, generally speaking, I would say I'm a traditional type of conductor in the sense that I love the classics. I love the core repertoire, which I think still resonates with audiences. Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, Berlioz, Mozart, you know, the names that are familiar to us. But traditional also in the sense that I think our programming needs to incorporate contemporary voices. That was always true, that symphonies were responsible for promoting the artistic voices of our time and of the day. And I'm traditional in that sense too, where I think that the great works need to have a balance of the voices of living composers, and that is, in a sense, traditional. So again, I do lean on the great repertoire and try to pepper in some works by living composers. That would be my programming personality.
We only have just a little bit of time left, and I want to be sure to talk to you about your vision of the future for classical music. What do you think needs to happen to keep present audiences engaged while also working to attract new younger audiences? For example, are you open to exploring roles for other genres?
Absolutely. Well, it's one of the most important issues facing the industry today. I am a firm believer that there's still a hunger for excellence in the communities of audiences, that whether they're coming to the symphony for the first time or they've been coming for generations, that there is always this desire for something extraordinary to happen on the stage, and that needs to be the vision for the future still. There needs to always be that focus on quality and excellence. And then you get into accessibility of your programming. How is it marketed? Are there popular shows mixed in with the classical shows? And I think Lexington Philharmonic does a beautiful job of that, of having a balance of programs that are meant to appeal to the subscription base versus the first-time audiences and younger audiences. The younger audiences will eventually come to a place where they have the time and means to enjoy season tickets for a symphony orchestra, and so we'll always see younger people coming on. I don't think it's a dying art form by any means. But my vision is always to keep the focus on the quality and to make the musicians realize that that is our mission, not to just present programs designed to attract audiences, but to always be doing our musical best.
In your experience, what do you think an orchestra does for the life of a community?
Many things, and especially when you think about the education and enrichment of the culture. There's so much behind the scenes going on with an orchestra like Lexington Philharmonic, classroom visits by the musicians, education programs designed for families with young people. So there's, you know, an introduction to the art form going on at the organizational level. But then there's also, what does this symphony do for the bigger picture of what is our community? By having a symphony orchestra at a high level, that speaks volumes for the kind of financial commitment of the community, the kind of support for the arts that exists in a community. So people looking from the outside will say, look at what we have, look at what cultural entities we have, and the symphony orchestra is always, in my mind, the peak of those entities. It's always the one that is sort of carrying the beacon of the cultural excellence in the community. So as the conductor, that's your role. You're a critical leader for engaging the community, setting the tone for the approachability of the organization, the personality, and for the musicians, too. They want to have a conductor and partner on the podium who they trust and believe in and can get behind. So we do a lot as a symphony orchestra for the life of any community.
One last very quick question. I'm just very curious. What has you excited about Lexington, Kentucky, thinking that, that's a place where I would like to bring my family to live?
Oh, it's a fabulous community. We have a few ties. I'm from Missouri, as I mentioned, St. Louis, and my wife actually grew up in Hart County, Kentucky, so we've spent much time there. Her folks still live down there, so great friends in the community. I also went to school in the Midwest, so know a few musicians in the orchestra, so that connection is still very strong for us. I just think it's a wonderful part of the world. You have Shakertown. You know, obviously, the university provides a wonderful community in and of itself. So Lexington has a lot to offer, and conducting is definitely a go-where-the-job-takes-you kind of lifestyle, and I think you could do a lot worse than a town like Lexington.
Thomas Heuser, candidate for conductor of the Lexington Philharmonic. Thanks so much, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Tom.
The conversation with Thomas Heuser is the first of six interviews with each of the conductor candidates. Up next in October, Akiko Fujimoto, associate conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra and recently appointed as the music director for the Mid-Texas Symphony. So what about Lexington-born composer Julia Perry? As I mentioned earlier, you can learn more about her by checking out that Tom Eblen column. We have a link on the facts and information page of our site, esweku.com. But an important way to get a true sense of her artistry is to listen to a sampling of her music. So let's take a moment. Here's conductor Karina Kanellakis leading the Los Angeles Philharmonic in a performance of Julia Perry's A Short Piece for Orchestra, recorded live at the Hollywood Bowl on September 11th, 2018. In a moment, genre shift. That's Mavis Staples. She was on the bill as Lexington hosted its very first Railbird Music Festival back in August. The feedback from music fans has been positive, and plans for Railbird 2020 are already underway.
By and large, what you'll see is a very similar event, hopefully improved where it needs to be, but largely, you know, we feel like we had a home run.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In August, Lexington, Kentucky tried something totally new, a two-day music festival at Keeneland. Art Checkett from our arts partner Undermain debriefs David Helmers, local producer of the Railbird Music Festival.
Why don't we start off by giving sort of a high-level look at the festival? How many people came? What was your attendance like? Did it meet expectations?
Attendance was great, particularly for an inaugural event. This was the first year we did this, so we were curious how the public would respond. We had 15,000 people on Saturday out at the grounds at Keeneland and 16,000 on Sunday. And so we're very happy with the overall response. Not only was it a good number of people, we had a great diversity in where they were coming from. I think we had 48 states plus the District of Columbia represented in ticket purchasers, and about a third of those folks had come from outside Kentucky. So we were really happy to have them here and show them some Lexington hospitality.
Yeah, I ran into a bunch of people from outside the state just walking around and talking to people at the festival. Did you have many international visitors at all?
I think 11 foreign countries were represented in the ticket purchasing demographics. And, you know, it just was a great opportunity for us to showcase Lexington, what we have here, what's special about this place. And, you know, as we talked about before, we tried to make that part of the festival by design. So I think the response has been really great. We had people who've never been to Central Kentucky, never been to Lexington, never bet on a horse race or been to Keeneland, and someone who told us they were going to taste bourbon for the first time while they came in August. So we really we loved having everyone here, and we think we showed them a heck of a good time.
Tell us about the overall level of satisfaction that you as a local co-producer with AC Entertainment have about the festival.
We're very satisfied. I've spent a lot of time since the festival wrapped debriefing with, you know, our partners and sponsors and participants, whether they came and participated as artists or chefs or just came and spent the weekend with us. And I feel like everyone liked the show. It turned out to be a great weekend, and we've done really kind of an A to Z analysis of every part of it, and I think we got most things right. So we feel really good about what we created and excited about continuing it.
That's great, because AC Entertainment, of course, was brought in because they have so much experience putting on festivals of all sizes, including very large ones like Bonnaroo. So for them to be satisfied is a big deal. What were your expectations going in, and did anything not meet those expectations?
Well, we did set a target of attendance, and we were very close to that. And, you know, you never know in a first year. I was talking to one of the executives at AC And I think he said it pretty succinctly. He said, we wanted to put on a world-class music festival in Lexington, Kentucky. That we achieved. You know, I think looking back on it, and someone else described it to me as nearly flawless. And that's high praise and makes us feel great. We did go through in kind of excruciating detail. Where did we miss? What do we have to improve? And what are we going to do next year that's a little different? You know, the hiccups we had Saturday night, traffic exiting was slower than we would have liked. It was really kind of all getting directed in on one route. We quickly fixed that. Sunday was a breeze. Other minor things are like, you know, trash can placement, having enough trash cans. And, you know, there's a long checklist, but they're really minor tweaks.
And how did the folks at Keeneland feel about how it went?
They report back to me that they were thrilled with the event. You know, Keeneland has a long history of hospitality. We wanted to provide a level of hospitality and graciousness that's equal to what people are accustomed to when they go at Keeneland. So they have a very high standard. I felt like we created an event that was on brand for them, but also unique. This was brand new for them. This was new territory. And we joked some about this was Keeneland's weekend to let its hair down. And we were very happy with it. And all the reports we've gotten back from Keeneland seem to indicate that they also were very pleased.
Let's talk about the music, the highlights of it. One thing I thought was that the sound quality at the festival was as good or better than I've ever heard at a festival.
Thank you.
And the stages were really separated, so the music didn't run into each other. Tell me what your reaction. You're a music lover. You go to hear lots of music. What were the highlights for you?
Well, first of all, I agree. The setup there and where we put the stages gave us enough distance between the two main stages that you didn't have a lot of sound bleed, so you could hear what you wanted to hear. For me, there were a lot of highlights. Brandi Carlile really was phenomenal. Such a talent, such great energy, and an incredible band. Did some really nice covers and just was a highlight. Same day, Mavis Staples, who's a legend. You know, I was hustling around a lot during the festival, checking on all kind of components, but those were some acts that I carved out some time to make sure that I got a chance to see. Both thrilling to me. Tyler Childers on Sunday had a huge crowd turnout, and I think it was a sort of a homecoming for him with a brand new album that's gone to number one on the charts. That was a lot of fun to see him perform and then also see the support that he got. We presented him with the key to the city before his set, and he seemed to really be appreciative of that. And we were appreciative of him performing here locally and doing such a great job. Those are just a few. I could go on and on. I will add that having some of the local artists perform and the setting that was the Burl stage, a more intimate stage, really was neat. I love the fact that the Wooks and Johnny Conqueror and Justin Wells, some of these players, got to perform and at the same event that some Grammy winners and number one and well-known international artists were performing. And then as a bonus, a number of those acts got written up in national publications. So for Justin Wells and the Wooks to get referenced in a magazine like Rolling Stone, how awesome is that?
I thought the Burl stage really knocked it out of the park in a way that, I mean, they do great shows locally, but I thought it was a really well-curated, well-put-together lineup of artists, and I thought the lineup worked great, and they had some great music coming out of that smaller stage and really good audiences for those performances.
For sure. They had some overflow crowds, it felt like, and it made it really fun. It just, you know, it was a little bit of a different experience than the big fields and the main two stages, and so you could mix it up and have a little more intimate setting at that stage.
Let's talk about some of the amenities and how you felt that the other things that you guys were presenting, food, bourbon, horse racing, betting, how did all that work for the festival?
We felt like, you know, in hindsight, and that was one of the things we talked about, that really none of those were a miss. We, you know, we're trying things that were very unique to Kentucky and also unique for a music festival. It's not often that you have culinary demonstrations with chefs preparing food at a music festival. So I think between the Sip and Savor activation, which was the culinary demonstrations, which were standing room only, people really seemed to enjoy. The Rick House, which was kind of the bourbon activation, made kind of a nice lounge area. the Phillies and Colts area, which was the children's area. Super well received, and some great partnerships there with like Living Arts and Science Center and some of our nonprofit groups. And then Lucky Day Plaza, the wagering pavilion where we were simulcast horse racing from Saratoga and Del Mar, and folk could vote. Across the board, we felt like they were successful, which was great and a little unusual. I thought, well, one of these, you know, maybe isn't going to be a hit, but we really felt like all of them were successful. We'll repeat all of them. We may change bits and pieces of them, but largely we'll expand on what we did there this year.
So we can expect Railbird 2.
You can expect Railbird 2. We're going to lock in a date. It will be in August 2020. And we're going to get hard to work at it pretty soon.
Any changes that you can tell us about that you think might occur in Railbird 2 in August 2020?
I think we're going to stick to format. I mean, the caliber of artists is really what this is about. The layout seemed to work. All those components, I'm sure we'll add some things and fine-tune some things. You know, we had breakfasts and dinners and kind of some kickoff events, but by and large, what you'll see is a very similar event, hopefully improved where it needs to be. But largely, you know, we feel like we had a home run and let's try and do it again.
It's a great thing for Lexington, Kentucky to have a big, big homegrown festival that brings in national and regional artists and on such a scale. And we appreciate it. And we really are going to look forward to Railbird 2 in August 2020.
Well, thank you so much. And we're looking forward to doing it again. And we just appreciate all the great support.
Thanks again, David. Bye-bye.
You can learn more about UnderMaine by going online to under-maine.com. And that's what we have for you this week. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on esweku.com, on weku.fm, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.